IT businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome to episode 48 of the Killing It Podcast. Little delay there as my voice goes the entire way around the world, 12 time zones. I am in Thailand, and these guys are in the Eastern time zone. So just having a good time here, you know, getting ready to go to Cambodia.
I think we're going to have a whole topic on your on the impact of the travels and the coronavirus and all that kind of stuff when you get back, Carl, because I think you've got another interesting stop. I think it'll be interesting to hear that commentary and then put it in perspective for everybody. So I think we'll break that out as a full topic when you get back.
Yeah, and it's interesting because there is a serious technological perspective to it as well. So our first topic today is cloud neutrality. You've all heard of net neutrality. So what's the deal with cloud neutrality? And I know Dave and I do not completely agree on this one.
No, we do not completely agree on these neutrality pieces, which will make it interesting. So Ryan found this article, and so I'll set it up and then throw there. We've all heard the debates around net neutrality and where those concepts come and the idea of keeping, you know, the allowing the data flow to be managed or cell access or that whole debate. The Wired piece talks about the need to discuss cloud neutrality, because with the build of these cloud infrastructures, essentially our basis all of many pieces of technology are now running entirely at the pleasure of a small number of large private companies. And the quote that I thought that was interesting to pull it out that gave great perspective to this was, "It would be as though Ford, GM, and Toyota had built the interstate highway system using private dollars and then charged tolls to other car makers to use it." Ryan, I know you had a couple of thoughts, you know, right away on this.
Yeah, very, very urgent thoughts, because I've been thinking about this for a number of years, right? Part of my career, I grew up in the cable industry, the telecommunications side of things, in addition to data networking. And I understand the debate around net neutrality, right? I've seen it from both sides, and I understand the cost and the complexity of building infrastructure, digging trenches, laying conduit, building antennas, and so forth. I understand there's money that goes in, and that needs to be recouped in the form of a business model. Totally understand and agree with that. But when we started in the net neutrality debate, the discussion around throttling based on, you know, whether you were a preferred provider or not in my business model, I had some issues. And again, I know we've discussed this in several months ago-ish episodes, but this topic actually clarified it for me in a completely different way. It's not about the pipe between you and I that we're discussing. It is my data ability. And when it comes to the cloud, it's my processing, it's my content, it's my data files and my applications that are or may be hosted in the cloud. And when somebody who is doing that hosting may actually also be a provider of competitive applications and content, the conflict of interest, I think, rises to the level of, like, you know, what they call an attractive nuisance. You know, in legal terminology, if you have a swimming pool in your backyard and you don't build a fence around it, you are liable if somebody gets hurt in that because it was an attractive nuisance. I think that's where we've gotten to with cloud neutrality. A few humongous companies have built resources to which we have all subscribed and centralized our content. And they also provide content. And I wonder whether we could see some crossing of the streams here.
Well, and my disagreement is that this seems like it's just exactly the same argument I heard 15 years ago, that, oh my gosh, you'd have to be scared. I mean, this article actually says, if you're not scared, you should be, right? And, you know, I understand there's the potential for evil. I'm just not seeing the evil that you're seeing, right? I'm not seeing it actually happening. In fact, what I'm seeing is, oh, Disney's going to start a new streaming channel, right? Like, they didn't come out of nowhere, and they're going to be a big player, right? It's like, as far as I know, every person I've ever met has signed up for Disney.
Well, sure. I mean, and a lot of that has to do with their decline in ESPN revenues, as they understood that the bundles that they were selling with ESPN, and they've got to move into streaming, and that's a lot of where that came from. But I would argue that, I mean, it's about these companies leveraging their positions to stifle innovation or to keep competitors from playing there. And I know we definitely disagree on this one, Carl, but I'm going to pick on Amazon today. This is distinctly my theme. Yeah, well, they're easy to do because, by the way, they're headed up by the most power, you know, most wealthy man in the world. You know, Amazon has leveraged their position and their profitability into squashing and destroying other market segments. My favorite examples: they purchase Whole Foods. The market rewards them with the entire value of the sale by taking the market value from competitors like Kroger and other supermarket players and transferring it to Amazon, essentially making the Whole Foods acquisition free. So that's my first one. You know, my second Amazon example is they put out a press release saying we're thinking about getting into healthcare. And a bunch of market value moves from healthcare providers over to Amazon because they're just thinking about it.
But, you know, both of those examples are examples of being really big and really rich and being monopolistic, not examples about using their cloud to leverage that or to keep other people. Like, they haven't kept anybody out of the grocery business because of their cloud technology.
No, right? What I'm reading from Dave's examples, what I'm reading from Dave's examples, there's a pattern of behavior, right? Again, from a legalistic point of view, they have shown a propensity to use the tools at their disposal for their advantage. Well, another one of the tools that they have at their disposal is this thing called AWS. And if you, well, I mean, they also provide entertainment and streaming and video content as well as original programming. They also provide application functionality and other professional services. And if you happen to work in one of the industries that they are in, and by the way, you happen to buy that cloud value proposition of hosting all your stuff somewhere off-prem, now, again, this is where the streams cross, and I start to say Amazon has a history of squelching other people in their industries. And now that they are in the cloud, they have the ability to not just compete against you, but to, I don't know, slow down the delivery of your content through their data center.
I agree with the theory, but what you're saying is they could do this. Right. But the evil that they've done so far has not been because of their position as a cloud provider. It has been because they own all the money.
Well, it's been financed by their position as a cloud provider. Let's distinctly point out that their machine.
But that's not a net neutrality, cloud neutrality argument. That's a really big companies with all the money need to be managed or regulated somehow.
Well, but this is the, you know, we have to be vigilant for behaviors. I think I would look and say that there are examples of leveraging net neutrality where these companies distinctly want to find new ways of making money. They are happy to do that. They have histories of doing it, and they are doing it in their own self-interest. The way this gets managed is by society deciding where the limits are. This is the debate we have to have is hey, where is our limit for this? Well, we have to ask the question.
And again, to understand what is at stake, right? In the net neutrality conversation, what was at stake was I created some stuff and then I wanted to send it to you using a quasi-public utility in between the two of us. They might hamper my ability to send stuff. This is an entirely different level of the stack. When my server, storage, networking, application, and data all live in the cloud, they have radically more influence on my ability to create and to operate than they would if it was just once I decided to send stuff outside of my four walls. This is all inside of my four walls.
I completely agree that could happen.
Right.
And actually, I agree with Dave. we should be vigilant, but we should not say this could happen, therefore we need to, you know, have some laws and regulate it and prevent something that has so far not actually happened.
Well, I mean, that is a bit of that moral and ethical debate over like, well, okay, do we have to declare it not true? Because I think we would all agree that these companies will move based on profit. That is their goal. It is not on based on we want to be good people or good citizens or just, like, that's not their motivation. Their motivation is to build the most profitable business they can. And so if we say by saying, by leaving it open and saying these are all unregulated decisions, they have every ability to go into there. Which comes first? Do you say it's wrong, or do you let them do it and then say it's wrong? That is really the debate we're having. Is the, and I happen to fall on the side of saying, hey, you know, I'd like to say that it's wrong before it happens. And my example on this is, like, for a long time, we let companies dump their chemicals into the river because that was the cheapest and most efficient way to dispose of toxic waste. We then looked and said, you know what, maybe clean water is a good idea. We should have some regulations around that. I liken this exactly the same way as if we've identified that we don't want them to do this, maybe we should say that and make it wrong before they start dumping chemicals in the water.
And maybe, right, like the motivation on this one, the reason that we need to pay attention to it now is that it's actually winning. Right, we're not talking about the cloud as a concern in a hypothetical sense. We're talking about it as a concern because very many customers, you and I included, actually believe in the value proposition of hosted off-prem remote type technologies. As that becomes more and more ubiquitous, it's going to be more and more influential.
Sadly, we are out of time for this topic, but as always, we will definitely come back to this. So topic number two today is interesting because it sort of follows from that a little bit. And, you know, before we had talked about trusted companies, you know, trust, who's trusted and what brands do people really rely on? And we were all shocked that the Postal Service was number one. But now there's an article that we're going to link to about who are the most evil companies. And, you know, I don't know that I'm surprised at anybody on this list. I'm surprised for some of the reasons people are on this list.
Well, I could have picked better ones in some cases.
Actually, that's true.
Is the, you know, some of, you're exactly right. Like, some of them are what? The one I wanted to cite first, because it parries off of the last topic, is, you know, number 16, our friends at Verizon. Verizon throttling the fire department's unlimited data during the California wildfires. Oh, I like it. It's not a clear-cut net neutrality thing,
right?
But they are very happy to throttle data and control it for economic reasons. I just say if you let them say it's okay, they're happy to keep going.
To me, that's more of an example of forever. You know, there's never been any such thing as unlimited bandwidth. Unlimited doesn't exist. If anybody tells you that, they're lying to themselves or to you. So
that's true. That is true. But again, it's the, if they can do it, they will. Right. And here is an example of that. And so, you know, again, sometimes you do have to say you're not going to allow yourself to do that. I think the list, first off, it is interesting that we are having this conversation around the moral responsibilities of organizations. And I think I'm going to keep reflecting.
That's a good conversation to have. Absolutely.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I am a good capitalist at heart. I think businesses are in the business of making money. It is society's job to say what is allowed and what is not allowed. And we collectively need to come to terms on which of these things we're going to allow and which we're not. It's the healthy privacy conversation that we're having. It's the data management conversation that we're having. It's all of those. That is a societal debate that we need to be having.
Well, and again, take this from the broad perspective down to the individual companies, right? The reason for the list is not just to pick on these individual companies. It is to make an observation that some businesses are here to help and other businesses are not necessarily here to help. Now, I will admit to my essential naive, glass half full, relentlessly positive point of view on these things. I tend to believe that most businesses are originally founded for a good reason, and then they, evolve into necessarily other elements that could have a negative impact. I think that that's usually why somebody founds a company. There's a customer with a need. I can solve that problem for money. Hey, that's a really good thing. But, and again, I'll go back to, some original theory around this, right? You go into the Wayback Machine and into your Peter Drucker 101 reference book. And one of the things that he said is that the firm exists for the purpose of satisfying the customer at a profit. Now, again, sequence matters here in this conversation. Satisfy the customer, do what's in the best interest of your customer. And if you can do that in a way that you can make money, good on you. Let's keep doing that thing. The question that this list represents, and I think some of the individual players especially represent, is I think they've reversed the sequence. They're here to make money. And by the way, if I can help you out in the process, cool. But if it comes down to my profit or your best interests, we all know who's going to win.
Right. Well, I think you need to draw the line. There's a distinction between unintended consequences and intentional evil. Right. There are people on this list, companies on this list, that they started out like creating products to sell to governments to allow them to spy on their citizens. Like, okay, we intended to be evil from day one. And then there's Airbnb promised that, rents would go down and rents went up. Like, not the same kind of evil. And, so I think we have to have these distinctions. Some things are byproducts of what you do for a healthy business, and it just falls into the unintended consequence.
Yeah, there is something to be said about a culture, the way cultures of companies do impact that, and the way their mentality. I'm going to pick on Facebook here for a moment,
because they're big.
Well, right, because they're big and they're easy to pick on. I'm punching up. Remember, I'm allowed to do that. So, a couple of details there. I mean, you think about their motto, move fast and break things. By its exact culture, they're okay with doing damage. They are okay with that. That is part of the company culture.
Well, and Uber started out the same way. Like, we're just going to break some laws and then see how much it costs us.
Right. Well, okay. That's not necessarily a good thing, particularly when you literally say, we're going to go out and break laws. Okay. Like, I mean, that is an ultimate level of disruption, and maybe some of, and there's a healthy debate to be had about whether or not those laws needed to be revised. But I'm going to point to, don't tell me that these are companies where I'm really comfortable with them ethically. By the way, we know that because the founder of Uber is out because of building a company culture that is, that was to the detriment of people. And surprise, surprise, that's also inherent in the way they were doing business. Well, we're just okay breaking laws. Right. Okay. You should look and say there is a certain degree of, okay, yeah, these are not great things. I've been making a big push, and I've been talking a lot about the fact that I do think that there is business value in doing things ethically. I think there is opportunity and a framework and a way to do that. It's not to say that there isn't one in doing poor things. Look, there's a great business model in cybercrime. People are making money on that. It's how you feel about that. And it is, again, it is up to us as society to make decisions about this. But we also have to understand the size and scale of these companies. More people subscribe to Amazon Prime than voted in the last election. And Facebook has a population bigger than the Southern Hemisphere in India. Those are staggering numbers when you really think about that, in terms of their size and influence of these companies.
And to be, you know, to be tactical about this, right? And I agree with Carl, you can agree or disagree with any of the people that are on this list or not on this list. The reasons are up for debate, but ultimately some of the reasons that companies were included in this list with, you know, obvious subjective preferences that were included is, you know, it could be undermining local economies. It could be undermining the interests of workers and labor. It could be that they're supporting government surveillance. It could be that they are harming the environment, or that they are doing things that are not in the best interests of their users, their employees, their shareholders, et cetera, right? What's interesting is any one of those things could have gotten your name included on this list. But as they point out, Amazon is the only company that has done all of those things on this list. And they've got the culture issues. They've got the tax issues. They've got a few problems out there. I think maybe we can come to a consensus on that.
I always use Amazon as my example of a truly evil company. And I sell through them and I own their stock. And, you know, but I agree with the idea that we need to say, look, what is an appropriate culture and how do we want to do this? Because some of these complaints, to be honest, are quite trivial. Like SpaceX is evil because they didn't paint their satellites black and it interferes with astrologists, right? And you know, Disney is taking some of their old films off of the Disney Plus, and it's like, okay, so evil constitutes, hey, not cool, dude, right? That's very different from Amazon, copying the best products that people have put up there, calling them, you know, the Amazon essentials, and then putting out of business companies that have made them millions of dollars.
Well, the thought exercise I want people to think about is I want you to swap in the U.S. government in exchange for one of these company names. If the list of things that Amazon has done, like install, you know, is listing devices and collect information and pushed employees to burnout and injuries, if the U.S. government did all of these things, I think the level of outrage would be intensely high on both sides of the political spectrum. And think about the monitoring and surveillance stuff and practices of a company like Facebook. And now switch Nazi Germany for that. Now it's a cliche. It's a super, we can all agree they're evil, right? That's why it's a great example. But I want you to think about those, if I replace the actions by governments, your outrage level generally shoots way up. But then think back to the stats that I was quoting. The population of Facebook is larger than the Southern Hemisphere in India. The number of people with Amazon Prime is more than voted in the last election. These are staggering numbers, and we do have to think about this.
So my final comment is that, you know, I part of the whole thing about, you know, the companies taking over, that's not new news, right? That is, when you're a science fiction fan, like this goes back to the earliest days of science fiction, is that the governments are going to step aside and the companies are going to rule the world. It turns out we're kind of heading in that direction. So sadly, we're out of time for that topic. But third topic today is something that sort of evolved from the discussion about all this new technology, all this new innovation, and yet Seth Robinson, as a guest host on The Business of Tech, said, this adoption is not being, it's not accelerating as quickly as we thought. It's not being adopted at the rate that we thought it would be.
Yep. I was really very honored that people were happy to help me take a vacation and sub in. So I gave a couple of pieces. So I would encourage people, if you haven't listened to it, Seth did a really good piece on emerging technology and its adoption. It's the Monday, February 17th episode of The Business of Tech. And he posited the question, really thinking about the way this is being adopted and the speed of that and how it's being rolled out. And, you know, I thought it was a really interesting conversation. And Ryan, I'm going to kick it to you because you had some immediate thoughts on this.
Yeah, you know, I look at it from, you know, kind of both my user and my business point of view. I think that now is the golden age of technology. There is more new, interesting, and legitimately valuable stuff that we can sell and that we can adopt to improve the world and our businesses and our lives than at any point in the history of our industry, right? The original dawn of silicon processing might have been the most transformational, but this is a very close second because we are utilizing digital technologies and we are using remote and automation and artificial intelligence. There's no shortage of remarkable and cool technologies. And yet, the vast majority of customers and organizations are not yet using these things. Now, this is always on my mind. And a while back, I came across a piece of research from a group called ESG, the Enterprise Strategy Group, if you're familiar with them. They were asking the question around one of Dave's favorite topics, digital transformation. They asked very large organizations, and they said, do you have at some point in this year, do you have the intention to deploy a digital transformation initiative? 88% of the people said yes. And then they said, have you already achieved business or economic value from your initiative? And only 5% said yes. So they followed up with a question, because I mean, statistically speaking, everybody's got one and nobody is getting a benefit from it. What was the obstacle? Number one on the list, far and away from the others, was we do not have people on staff who have these skills for developing, customizing, implementing around advanced technologies. In other words, the tools have outstripped the skills of the users to benefit from those tools. That's a fascinating question for developers, right, but also for outsourced service providers in the channel.
So I have been, for about 2 years now, I've been doing a keynote on welcome to the exponential century. Like, all these things are reaching exponential growth at the same time. And it's literally all the stuff we talk about on this show. And at the same time, my first question that I get from the audience is always like, are you sure the cloud is safe? And I'm like, I'm going to slap you. I'm going to jump off the stage. You know, Dave is taking over a class. I'm teaching this class on cloud services. Dave is taking over a class for me because the person who normally would take over a class for me doesn't do cloud services in a modern way. Like, they literally build servers on virtual machines in the cloud. And Dave's like, why would
they crazy? They're crazy.
But it's exactly, I mean, that is a perfect example of why we're not innovating as fast as we should be. We're not implementing the innovations as fast as we should be. People have to update their skill set. So what you were saying, Ryan, is exactly true. I mean, we've talked about AI programmers earning $300,000 in salary, right? We can't find people to retool fast enough. And if there's one lesson for our listeners, it's this: go back to school. Go get trained on this new stuff, because you will be the only one in your market and you will make a fortune.
Well, Seth's argument is that we've moved from technology in isolation to technology in ubiquity. And thus, we've arrived at the place that we've been moving to for a very long time. And markets where it's ubiquitous and potentially commoditized in some ways move at a very different pace than those that are accelerating and innovating. I think it's debatable. I definitely think that we still view technology as an infant or early marketplace, but I don't think it really is. I think it's much closer to mature than it is to infancy, and we have to reevaluate our thinking based on that.
Well, but this is the thing, right? It's the tools, platforms, and technologies are approaching maturity. The deployment, application, utilization of them are not. And that's an essential difference, right? To borrow a different piece of research here from the folks over at IDC on a related topic, but different from the digital transformation, they're talking about IoT, right? And they're looking at that's cool technology. We're interested in some use cases, but we're not seeing necessarily humongous adoption of these things. And they're trying to plot out the next few years of, you know, how long will it take before everybody says, yep, I'm getting into IoT, and then they have requirements and whatever. This data point should ring every bell for every company that works in any way in the channel. By 2021, 75% of organizations embarking on an IoT project indicate that they will require the participation of a systems integrator / service provider to strategize, plan, deploy, and or manage the initiative. Okay, so A, we don't have those skills on staff. We just literally don't have the humans on our team who can do these things. B, if you do anything in the world of technology and you are not paying attention to how you can be that guy they outsource to for planning, strategizing, developing, et cetera.
Only guy in North America.
You are going to be a dinosaur left behind in this. I mean, I saw that statistic and my channel brain almost exploded. The end user is telling us, I will spend massive amounts of money on the IoT and I don't have skills, and I will spec in a requirement for you to get paid to come and help me do that.
And the adoption question is always one of these things where nobody can figure it out until suddenly somebody figures it out, and then boom, like that's it. It's over. And it was like, it happens in 20 minutes, and then nobody questions it again. So, you know, but also there's an element that is not about the technology and it's not about the service providers. It's about the existing political infrastructure. Like, oh yeah, we don't allow people to do that. We don't, you know, we don't have rules for that. We don't, you know, whatever. It doesn't fit into the way we've always done things, you know? And so sometimes technology is like held back with chains because, oh no, you got to fill out this in paper. You can't use an electronic form.
Right. Well, there's that too.
but again,
literally that simple, right?
I agree. Right. And I mean, I'll refer back to what I think is one of the smartest quotes I ever had from somebody who I know well, T.C. Doyle. We all know him in the industry. Wrote a book a few years ago, and he made a comment that said, change happens very slowly until it comes on all at once. And I think that that is where we are. We know that these things are coming. There's phenomenal capabilities in the pipeline, and everybody's trying to figure it out. And when they do, to Carl's point, you're going to see things that apparently happened overnight. And they couldn't possibly have happened overnight. They've been in development for years and years.
Right. So I'm in Thailand, and somebody was telling me this morning about that modern phones that did do everything literally didn't exist here until about, you know, a year ago. Everybody had these old Nokia pieces of crap, right? And then one company made the phones cheap enough that suddenly it became reasonable to actually own one of them. And then all of a sudden, smartphones were everywhere. And so, like, you 2 years ago, you couldn't have sold an app in Thailand because nobody had a phone to run it. And now they're literally everywhere. And it has changed society, you know, because once a smartphone exists, all kinds of other stuff happens. So anyway, it's a very interesting thing.
Well, we wouldn't be in this if it wasn't interesting. Unplug. You know what? Just leave your phone behind. I know. I'm just rolling off vacation, and it was delightful to not pay attention to my phone. It's
very cool. Well, that is it. Thank you all for listening. This has been yet another half hour wasted on the Killing It podcast.
Come on!
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.